What is it like to be a clinician with a patient who either comes because they're going to be dying or it happens in the treatment? And what is it like for the clinician? It's lonely in a way because there is a lot of parallel with what the patient's going through. And to me, as a field, I would like to think we could talk about this, write about it. My peer group at the time was terribly important to me. Colleagues, people that basically would be with me in this. But in the end, you know, I was the one that went to alone the service at the funeral home. And I went to my patient's luncheon, not to have the lunch, but to talk to the family. And then I left. I didn't stay for the lunch. I thought that might be a little intrusive. But there's nothing really to read about, talk about, whatever, pick somebody's brain about how did they experience this in their work. Or I don't really understand why we've been so quiet about this in our work.
You mentioned about being alone in it, and there is a way in which it's very true. I think in large part because not many of our colleagues have had this experience, and they're often the people we talk to. But on the flip side, maybe because I've worked with so many patients and that I'm beginning to notice a certain consistency, maybe it's me, but I've also had such an experience of close intimacy with these patients in a way that I don't always. And there's a closeness that's to be had, particularly in analytic work and work over time. But it happens quite quickly, I feel, in work with dying patients. And in that regard, I felt less alone in my work. In some ways, in the rest of our work, because we maintain a more careful distance in a way, a boundary with the patient, a frame, I feel with the dying patient, I feel like both of us are more in the room together.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my two guests today are Drs. Mark Moore and Peggy Warren. And our conversation today is around the issue of the patient who is dying. And this can take many forms, one of which is patients can come to us with a serious or terminal illness, or alternatively, they can develop a serious or terminal illness in the course of our work together. And we consider both experiences on the part of the clinician. We cover lots of ground. These two are very experienced and deeply thoughtful clinicians in the face of this very challenging clinical situation. We talk about home visits, boundaries, charging fees, feeling overwhelmed, love in the treatment, saying goodbye, speaking of dying, and ultimately, what does psychoanalysis have to say about the dying experience? Just to give you a taste of what their own personal resumes have been like, Dr. Moores has worked for many, many years with dying patients. He's a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst, and he works in private practice in Philadelphia. He was the director of psychological services at the Abramson Cancer Center at Pennsylvania Hospital, where he supervised psychology interns and postdoctoral fellows during their psycho-oncology rotation. He was the director of the psychotherapy training program for 6 years at the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. He teaches there widely. He's the recipient of the 2020 Edith Sapshin Teaching Award from the American Psychoanalytic Association. He works with neurology residents in sort of a Ballant type group. He's written widely on the subject. And as you will hear in his conversations, he's deeply immersed in working with these kinds of patients. Dr. Peggy Warren is a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst in Boston. She danced professionally early in her life with the Giordano Dance Chicago from ages 15 to 21, which has created a lifelong interest in the effects of creativity and mentoring on human development. She then went on to medical school at Rush University, and she was chosen in medical school to be the Osler Honor Fellow in Pathology Oncology, where she was first exposed to dying patients. She was awarded the Nathan Freer Prize for Excellence in Medical Student at graduation, and she said she used the prize money to buy a complete works of Freud and began to learn about the power of the unconscious. She did her psychiatric residency at Mass General Hospital, and she pursued analytic training and graduated from the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. She has taught widely, she lectures, and she presented on the dying patient at the 2017 American Psychoanalytic Association meetings, and she has been in private practice in Boston as a psychoanalyst for 38 years. I found my conversation with them to be indeed a privilege. To learn from them about what they have been doing in this work, to see how they immerse themselves in the thoughtfulness and tenderness of this work. I found it a very moving and important conversation, and I hope you do as well. Here is my conversation with Mark and Peggy. Mark and Peggy, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you both here. Nothing captures the exquisite tension between the literalness and the metaphoric aspects of the analytic relationship as when one of the two parties becomes physically ill. And a shorthand that we use is our concept and practice of what we call boundaries to represent that tension. And this tension exists whether it be the analyst who becomes physically ill or the patient. And when patients are ill, which is what our focus today will be on, it can take one of two forms. They can come to us with a serious or terminal illness, and that frames the entire treatment. Or, alternatively, they can develop a serious or terminal illness in the course of the analysis. And today we're going to consider both experiences with a special focus on a healthy woman who developed a terminal illness in the sixth year of her otherwise thriving analysis. And I want to mention, we've had two other episodes where we've had conversations around this topic. One was with Linda Emanuel, who is a psychoanalyst and a palliative care physician, and with Norman Straker, who is a psychoanalyst and a psycho-oncologist. And those episodes will be linked in the show notes. But I'd like to begin with Mark. Mark, you have extensive experience treating patients who come to you with cancer. And before we turn to the particular case, why don't you familiarize us with the work that you've been doing?
Yes. Back in 2003, I was an intern in here at Pennsylvania Hospital, and they began a rotation at the Associated Cancer Center at the hospital. And just to clarify, I'm a clinical psychologist, so the internship is a year, usually followed by a fellowship. And my graduate school background, I had an interest in hypnosis in addition to psychodynamic psychotherapy. And when I made my choice for internship, I decided to go the psychoanalytic route and chose Pennsylvania Hospital, which was predominantly psychoanalytic, not knowing I would actually have an opportunity to work with ill patients, physically ill patients, cancer patients. So when this was offered to me, I jumped on it. I was very excited, thinking in my mind that I'd probably be bringing to bear some of my use of hypnosis for relief of pain, anxiety, which I did. But I hadn't given much thought to the fact that I would also be working with patients who were often in the groups of fear of dying or who would actually die until I began working on the rotation. And after 6 months, I found myself really just caught up in the work in a way that I'd never quite expected, and realizing that I wanted to make this a focus, in part because I was so struck by how alive, focused, and engaged patients were in the face of death. And when my fellowship year was starting, I asked if I could actually make it a focus of my fellowship. And halfway through my fellowship year, the administrators at the Cancer Center asked me if I would actually want to stay on as the director of their new psychological services. And I gladly said yes, and stayed there for 10 years, supervising, teaching, and seeing quite a range of patients and family members. So some of my background.
And everyone who came to you came with a terminal diagnosis?
No, actually not at all. I think that was often what my colleagues who were working outside of cancer assumed, that there was a preponderance of working with dying patients facing death, that the work itself must be grim, despairing, great burden on me as a therapist. And in fact, it was quite mixed. The vast majority of my patients were patients who would have sometimes an uncertain prognosis, but very often, a course of treatment would come through it and would enter remission. And a lot of the work in therapy was around the holding of that anxiety, the fear that it could come back. And for many of them, it didn't. I've had patients I've been working with for over 20 years. The number of patients who would die would probably somewhere in the range of about 1 in 10 patients, 1 in 15. And I'm aware that that's actually a very high number when I think of the many, many patients I saw over time. And talking to colleagues who rarely have had a patient die in them, occasionally one or two, and that's often quite a high number in our practice. More often than not, the patients who came in knowing that they were going to die were actually quite few. The other part that was difficult in that was there would be occasions where in my work with the medical team, I would have a better sense of the prognosis. And yet the medical team were not being direct with the patient because there were still, various ways in which they could talk about treatment options and having hope. So that was an interesting conflict for me. Sometimes I would be ahead of the patient in not knowing for sure. And so I had to find myself living in the uncertainty with them, which I found was actually a very useful part of thinking analytically, so as not to be so far ahead and to be so sure that they would actually die. But often that was the case.
You mentioned holding the anxiety. While analysts may not have a large N of people who die in their practice, they undoubtedly have a real acquaintance with, either in their offices or in their own lives or in family members, who have had, shall we say, bouts with cancer, and are on the treadmill of getting scanned every so often to see if it returns. And unless someone has had that experience, and you are so exquisitely vulnerable, or you or a very close loved one is so exquisitely vulnerable, you don't really know what that terror is like every time you get a CAT scan or MRI. It's it's a special experience, shall we say.
Yeah.
And I'm sure all of us are in some way familiar with that. Peggy, let's talk about your situation because it's somewhat different. You had a patient who came to you and you said she was similar in age to you. And that's something that we're going to take up. And everything was going along fine. You describe it as a very rich and satisfying for both of you analytic journey. And then all of a sudden. So why don't you start by telling us a bit about the patient, and then you have written this up for a presentation some time ago. It is disguised. And you can walk us through your experience with her, and we can consider it both how it informs your encounter with her and how it speaks to the issue in general.
Well, this was a wonderful woman, gifted, interpersonally gifted, and she and I were about similar ages and in a similar stage of life. We were very involved in, I was working, but also mothering, and that's where she was at as well. And she brought a lot of gifts to her treatment. She was very bright, psychologically minded, very warm. She had a strong sense of making community and other relationships. So she brought a lot of joy in a way, and vigor to her treatment. And it was a relatively smooth treatment that was surrounding really a central idea of separating from her parents, who had a longstanding family business that the patient was working in, but was actually yearning to be with her children. She had three children at home, a very solid marriage, and she knew she was missing the joy at home. So the analysis was really around the separation, the individuation from her mother, but that uncovered a long-standing sense of feeling inadequate as a mother, because her own mother was very demeaning and critical of her wish to be a mother and be with her children. It was, her mother was a very gifted intellectual woman, and making success in the world and at work was the value. So when I moved her analytic hours, my patient, so she could pick her kids up from school, be with her kids. One child was very young, which I just took to mean as something I would do for a patient to enhance her mothering. This became like the centerpiece of the treatment early on, that she was so shocked that I would actually value that. And that started a lot of material that unfolded about her wishes about being a mother and her wishes about not being criticized for that. So she was very joyous about actually leaving the family business, which was a huge decision, and being with her kids. So things were going along quite well. And 6 years into this, we began sort of talking about termination maybe in the upcoming year, because she was having ideas of actually working part-time on a creative idea that was very different than what she'd come from, as she integrated that with being a mother. And then I had an August vacation, and the plan was we would revisit this in September. And my thought was we were in sort of a pre-termination phase. And that's where everything took a turn, which is that this is a patient that really never called me out of hours. And I suddenly got a call from her asking me to call her back immediately. And she told me she'd had a routine physical and was found to have a metastatic malignant cancer, basically with no treatment And she had multiple consults, and the general opinion was there was nothing they could do. And they gave her about a year to live. So this was like, for me, a bomb going off that, I mean, this woman was also very healthy and a runner, very interested in healthy eating, was a foodie, a gardener. So she'd be the last person in the world you would think of, and she was young. Mm-hmm. So for me as the analyst, it was so shocking that it took me hours, actually, after I spoke with her on the phone to realize she was dying, and our new task was I needed to get her through this somehow, even though this was the first time I had dealt with this in my work, in my practice. I mean, being a physician, I had seen and been with dying patients, but this was different. This was a very intimate relationship. I was 18 years into my private practice, so but I had never encountered this. And it was truly shocking for me to even integrate. It took me weeks to integrate and then to figure out how to care for her.
Right. And I think a useful way that we can have a conversation about this is to read sections that you wrote up about the encounter between the two of you and spend time on it, because it brings up all kinds of issues. You have both said to me that your work with dying patients changes the way you look at this work, not to mention how it changes us individually. So we're to get to that as well. Do you want to start us off by reading some of the verbatim notes that you have?
Yeah. So, you know, as an analyst, I was in a completely new realm that I'd never been in and also had not heard about or studied or read about. So this is a very early hour after my patient, Mrs. K, was diagnosed. And she says, I'm too weak to drive and sitting in the car is very painful. The last round of chemo was brutal. I'd rather see you than talk on the phone, because we were on the phone at that point. We could meet at my house. My mother's there. She'd take the kids out so I could have the privacy to meet with you. Although the kids would love to meet you, and so would my mother, and she'll probably want to horn in. But that's not a problem for me. I'll tell her to leave us alone. And I said, well, the visit could be a good idea. How do you think it would feel to have me in the house? And when I was writing this up, I made a note here that I flinched when I thought of this years later, because I would have handled it differently. I remembered how I had internally stiffened at the thought of going to her home. But this was life and death, and Mrs. K was making a human request. She knew much more about how time could shorten, and she needed to use it wisely. Why was I exploring how she felt? She was telling me it was okay. Then Mrs. K said to me, okay, fine. It'd be nice to see you rather than only hearing your voice. So if I'm too sick to sit up, I'll lie down. And I said, well, right. We should talk some more to make sure you'd be comfortable with this. And I'm glad to come and see you. And your mother would be there. I don't know how that is for you. And then Mrs. K laughed quietly. And she said, it's really okay with me. I'm very adapted to having people come see me, people I care about. My mother's better with me now, and she's helping me with the kids. But I think this might be more of a problem for you. And I said, so you're ahead of me in this one. And we laughed. And I was struck by my own projections and what a good supervisor she was.
One of the things among many that moved me about this write-up in general, and this is a very good example, is about you, Peggy. You're so honest with us, the reader and the listeners, when you you're sharing with us your awkwardness, certainly understandable, and your vulnerability in approaching this. And I just want to note that you're being generous with us in doing that. So thank you.
And my terror.
And your terror. You're sharing that as well.
Terror.
But this whole subject of home visits, Mark, I know you have a lot of experience with that. Help us out here.
Yes. I'm trying to recall my first response to a patient. And I remember the patient and the first home visit. The situation was different for me, just to add a bit of context. And I really do feel for what you were experiencing, Peggy, because I think it's such a different scenario when you're working with a patient a certain way and you're in the frame and there's good work coming out of it. For me, I was at the start of my training when I took this job. And so I was trying to figure out both ways of thinking of myself as a therapist. I think it was a good challenge for me. And over time, you know, I think I eventually made something of it. But with the house visit, I think what made that somewhat easier for me was I was used to not only working with patients in my office, but I was also having to see them in the chemotherapy suite. It was kind of catch as catch can. Uh-huh. And go to visit them if they'd had, you know, a bad reaction to chemotherapy and they were in the hospital and we were scheduled to meet that week. I very quickly had to adapt. I couldn't, you know, prioritize the frame. Like, it has to be in my office. I'd never see my patients or see them 50% of the time.
Right.
And there was one individual, I'll call him Leo, beautiful man, in his 80s. And he had come to me. He was undergoing chemotherapy. The prognosis was uncertain at that point, but he had a pretty serious sarcoma, and he was having some difficulties. And if I recall, it might have actually been the tumors themselves that were creating difficulty with balance for him. So that he had a fall at one point when he was in the shower, and then he started developing anxiety symptoms, having mild panic attacks as he was thinking about having a shower on his own. And he came to me to get past that. And we ended up having a very fruitful therapy, part of which initially was around the panic, but we were very easily able to open up that out into a broad fear of dependency, fear of dying, losing control, all of which were themes in his life. And so we worked for several months together. And unfortunately, he didn't respond well to the chemotherapy and his cancer began to progress to the point that he had to be at home. He was on hospice care. And we had time together to talk about whether or not we would continue our work. And one option, obviously, at that point was by the phone, Zoom. I guess Skype wasn't quite a thing then. But his house was on my way home. And to me, it just felt like a very natural thing to offer because it didn't feel, at least on my end, that I would find it burdensome. I wanted to continue the relationship with him. And also because we had been working together, I couldn't imagine depriving both of us of that relationship for as long as we could remain working together. And we continued our work, and much of it was, in fact, around how he was finding shift in his relationships with the people who would come to visit him. And of course, he was not only talking about friends and families, this was also talking about our relationship. And he was, one particular day, I remember he was concerned that he wasn't quite as alert as he normally would be. And that's actually something that always impressed me about him. He was very with it, very sharp, very engaged. So this is something he was feeling subjectively, and he was worried that he was wasting my time. And so that gave me an opening to talk about mm-hmm. our relationship, what he imagined my visiting him meant, his belief that it was a burden to me. And we were able to also understand it in the context of how he was receiving visitors, how he felt, you know, he was becoming the center of attention when his tendency in life was to take care of others. And so we had a very rich conversation around it. But also, while I felt we were able to make use of some of the transference and the fantasies he had with regard to what the visit meant to me, I also didn't want to leave this so open because the work, there was an element of time in it. He was dying. And so I didn't feel we could just let the transference sit. And I felt we'd used it well enough. And so I actually shifted into also letting him know that his house was on my way home. And so it wasn't a burden in that regard. And that was an interesting moment for me, right? Because there's this opportunity, if you think about it from an analytic perspective, we've got this opening, you know, transference, we can stay there for a while. And I think that's something that changes when you're working with a patient who's dying. You don't have the luxury of the time. But there was a beautiful moment at the end. This was a few weeks before he died, one of our last sessions. And he came back to this concern about my coming, because now it was wintertime and he was worried that I was walking to his house and it was cold and the weather wasn't great. And I didn't say anything immediately in response to that, but he had this wonderful insight. He just paused a moment. He says, you know, I guess in a way you coming here is you outside of your comfort zone. And he said, this, I think, maybe helps us both feel something, because I'm in a stage of life now that is so uncomfortable. He didn't just mean physically. He felt the whole stage, the experience of saying goodbye, of leaving all his loved ones, of people coming to him, taking care of him. And I just thought this was the moment I realized, while you may be facing death, you're still so capable of engaging in the relationship, of being able to move into something together. And so for me, that was such a gift from this patient in regard to how
and
I thought about it.
Caring about you. And yeah. Caring yeah. about you.
Yeah.
Through
yeah.
all this.
Yes. That's lovely.
It's lovely. It
yes.
is. Very moving.
Yeah.
He was lucky, Mark.
Yeah?
He was lucky to have you.
I think it was very mutual. Yeah. Yeah.
yeah. It touches on this issue of boundaries and the meaning it has to both parties. So, Peggy, why don't you read on? Because this becomes important, obviously, in your care of her.
So, just so your audience knows, so this was a very, very rabid cancer. And my patient went from being a vigorous woman to extremely sick very quickly. The following 9 months of the medical treatment were really harrowing for Mrs. K. The psychotherapy that we were in at that point was extremely difficult for both of us, but there were a few moments when we actually could laugh. We had to use the phone for most hours because she was so sick from the chemotherapy or the pain from the spread of her tumors. I worried about transgressing the boundaries by going to her home on a regular basis, and I kept continuing to explore it whenever she brought up the idea. However, she was so sick at times that a home visit was out of the question. I thought then how new this was for me. A terminally ill patient, a patient who was in an intense treatment, starting to terminate from loved ones, life, and me. I felt like I was learning as I went. I was trying to stay with her and the material elaborated, but keeping my eyes on the boundaries. Ms. K's suffering was so excruciating to watch. I noticed at the time I silently clung to my concerns about the boundaries. This must be to mitigate my own pain. That's what I was formulating then, and to not overwhelm Ms. K. But later, I saw it was much more than clinging to my boundary concerns. But it was more like a subtle rigidity and projection of my own concerns about becoming overwhelmed myself. Ms. K seemed quite at ease and safe about the boundaries. She wanted to talk about dying, and she was hard at work in her review of her life. Although Mrs. K was intensely sad, it was I, not she, who is trying to manage a fear of becoming overwhelmed while bearing the intensity of her sadness and mine.
Overwhelmed. It's a powerful word, but it reveals the volume of distress, but not the particularities of it. Do you have a sense of what was threatening to overwhelm you? Was it the loss or sadness or confusion, frustration, guilt?
Well, that's where my growth really ensued from this patient, because at the time I thought it was the fear and the distress and the intense sadness of losing her, mm-hmm. and also going through this illness. What I learned subsequently, much later, as I was reconstructing my part in this, is I was learning much more about what this touched her death and activated in me. And what initially began to present is I was slowly getting to the point that I felt very pressured to see her, to say goodbye. That's how it first presented. In watching her and talking to her suffering. I had been through this before with a father who had died of a brain tumor very quickly around her age. I really didn't get to say goodbye to him for many reasons. He became comatose. It wasn't something he could do, really. But it was an unfinished death, in a way, for me. And so the first thing that Ms. K was really starting to stimulate was this feeling of, we need to say goodbye. This can't be unfinished.
And she helped you with that?
She helped me in that I was close to her and I was thinking about this. And then it was later, after she had died, that I began to realize why I had certain very intense feelings about saying goodbye, being with her. It took me a while to reconstruct that this was also about my own father. And her.
Sure.
And me.
Right. Let me ask a concrete question. And I know people handle this differently, speaking of boundaries and overwhelmed. I know some people who work with dying patients manage charging by just charging as they ordinarily do. And some people feel that this is something other, that this is something that one doesn't charge for, or they don't feel comfortable charging. How do you each think about that? Do you think of it differently with different patients? Is there a feeling associated with it? What's it like for you? Mark, you want to start us?
Yes. It's... For many patients, there's a way to, I have to be honest, there's a way to avoid this issue, which is if you're seeing older patients, for example, with myself, I take Medicare. And so In a way you can avoid the feeling that it's, you know, personally asking the patient who's dying, oh, can you pay my bill also? Mm-hmm. But I don't think it can be avoided because it's there's still a frame of this being you acting as a professional. And I have a specific thought about a patient who's dying. I accept there's not going to be a final bill, which I think is fraught with a lot of meaning. But I'm not worried about, you know, that do they need to pay, for example, weekly, because, you know, next week might be their last session. To me, that it, there's something concrete about that, and to be honest, for me personally, I find it crass. It's a strong word to use. I don't mean to knock people who, like, we have to make a living. If all I was seeing was terminally ill patients, it'd be very different. Just like if I was a hospice nurse, right? You have to be paid. You have to bill. But for us, I think it's so complicated by the fact that this is often an involved, intimate relationship, and this person is dying. And So for me, as long as they're well enough for me to bill them, of course, I'll keep doing what I've always done. And I think the patient would struggle with that if I didn't. And right. Like, why are you treating me differently? But as it gets to like the last days, the last week, it's not that I don't log my hours, but not with the assumption that, you know, who am I going to send it to? I remember one family, I'd done a final house visit, very meaningful one. And the husband greeted me in the way, at this point, they had just realized she was dying. And it was really going to be in the next 24 hours. And he was clearly shocked. Oh, interesting. Actually, I'm misremembering this. This is telling. I had visited her. We had a very meeting 2 days before. And then the family asked me to visit because she didn't seem like she was very responsive. And I had a sinking feeling in my stomach that the family were possibly in denial. That I went in knowing and not knowing that she might be dead. Mm-hmm. And she was. And her daughter was in the room. And the daughter, I think, was holding more of the reality. The father was having a harder time with it. And very understandable. And they wanted me to essentially kind of bring in that reality. And now I'm not a medical practitioner, psychologist. But I was able to say, she doesn't seem to be responding. She doesn't seem to be breathing. Mm-hmm. But you'll need the nurse to come. But when I walked out, I remember that the husband was just heartbroken, but also turned to me and said, thank you for coming. And he just realized in that moment, his wife was dead. And he said to me, he said, so for today, how can we pay you? And I was just, no.
I have no idea what you're about to say. How did you manage that?
I was like, please. I don't even remember my words, but it was the effect of, please do not worry about that.
Right.
And that was it. And I never, you know, reached out with a bill after that. I could have. He clearly ended up. Sure. At that point, it was, for me, the more meaningful thing was that I had come at this last moment. For sure. Me, that was an experience I'd never had before. The thought of needing or wanting to be paid at that point is not that, you know, one session isn't going to break me. And it was
Did you feel, just to play with that a little bit, did you feel that by his saying that he was trying to organize himself in reality, which you just said he just realized his wife died? Well, but the reality is also you're a professional and you're supposed to get paid. Could you see that as part of his shoring up his reality testing in the face of feeling overwhelmed?
I think he was doing a lot in that moment. And part of it may have been to further validate, you know, what I was saying, which is she seems to be dead. You know, if I'm to be paid, I'm the professional who could pronounce that, which technically I wasn't. But I think it was in that moment, yes, he was trying to hold on to the world as it was crumbling in a way around him, just because there was so much shock in that moment that I think that was part of what was occurring. And if we brought it into that realm of the bill, I think intuitively, I don't know if I was right in this moment, but my intuition was that was bringing us back again away from reality that she was dead.
Got it.
That it's business as usual.
And the family needed you at the death, it sounds like, to be with them.
Yeah.
They didn't call the coroner.
Right.
They didn't call the funeral home. They called you.
Yeah.
Peggy, how have you managed this?
Well, it's such an interesting question because I hadn't thought of it, Harvey. And when we talked about putting this podcast together, I actually went back in my files because this was 20 years ago and looked at my billing cards. And from the moment of my patient's diagnosis, there was no more bills.
Really?
And I think part of this really had to do with it was a terribly intense treatment. And she got sick so fast that it's not like we had 2 or 3 years to sort of work with this.
Right.
Coming to my office, she was sliding immediately. And then the chemotherapy just about killed her several times. We had one moment where she had like a 1 week kind of remission, maybe, where she could eat again, cook again, drive again. And she came to my office She brought me this beautiful bouquet of flowers. She wanted to thank me. And it's an hour. I know we all have this in our work that I will never forget, because I was so stunned by how she looked. Because on the phone, or this is, by the way, this is pre-Zoom days, right, pre-FaceTime. So on the phone, in a way, even though she's very, very ill, it sounded like her. When she walked in, it sounded like her, but she had lost, she was a tiny person to begin with, and she was cachectic with no hair and a pallor. And it was all I could do to sort of like keep my composure. And I had this thought that I wrote about, that her mind and spirit is so alive. She was laughing and joking, but her body is dying. It was awful, just awful. And that was a very poignant moment, because it was the last time we were in my office together.
Let's segue, if it is that, from the issue of charging to the issue of love. Why don't you read the next segment, which touches upon this as it lived between the two of you?
This is more from the treatment now. As Ms. K's cancer came surging back over the next few months, her thoughts were more keenly on her relationship with me. We spoke exclusively on the phone, and there were days she couldn't muster the strength to talk, and sometimes she wanted me just to talk to her, and other days she had to cancel. The calls, every call, was so poignant. So here's a little bit of one. Ms. K, I don't know how I would have done this without you, without my treatment. I'm able actually to die now. I couldn't die without the therapy. I mean, die with some sort of peace. I know who I am, and I made the right decisions. I love my husband. He was the right guy to marry. I'm so glad I quit work to stay home with my kids. God, the time with them was so precious, and I didn't even know then that I was going to have such a short life. And without the treatment, I'd still be at work hoping to please my parents. I would have missed all of that time with my kids. That would have made dying even more horrible. You've been so important to me. I wanted to thank you for all you've done. We've really clicked. And I said to her, we really did click. We're really a good team. We're always liked each other, and we had a lot in common. And then she interrupted me. Yeah, I always thought actually we should have been social friends. We would have been great friends. I was always sad that I'd met you as my psychiatrist, because it would have been a great fit as a friendship. And I said to her, it's true. If we'd met in another context, this would have been a very good fit as friends. And I was feeling less constrained then, as I felt the time shortening. And I was trying to stay with her and manage my own grief. I was surprised with her ease in talking about dying. She said, yeah, you couldn't get it. I was comfortable with all that. It wasn't a problem for me. All through the treatment, you're just figuring that out now. And we laughed. And I said to her, you're right. You are fine with it. And so am I. But you've been ahead of me. But I'm catching up. And we laughed. And I said, I've enjoyed the work we've done together, too. This is a very important relationship for me as well. It's a friendship for me as well. And it grew up around this experience we had. And I feel so privileged to know you. I wanted to say that I would miss her at that point, but I didn't. It felt just too awful. And I felt outraged that she'd gotten this diagnosis, and how her family and the world would be deprived of her, how I would be deprived of her.
And then you go on to say about how you say, it sounds like you're getting ready. Can you?
Yes. That's as we got very much towards the end. This is now several weeks later. I said to her, it sounds like you're getting ready. And I was very quiet for a moment. You're such a fine person. I said to her, this is so very hard, but you have been so brave and so honest and so caring of your family. I'll miss you, and I'll always keep you with me in my thoughts. I'm so glad I'm coming to see you the day after tomorrow, because we'd made this date. And she said, thank you. You know, I've always loved you. I'm so lucky. You've really been there for me. And you're just so easy to love. And I said to her, thank you. I feel like that about you. We've really shared a loving bond. And you're such a unique person and such a gem. I'm so very lucky. And then I talked to her about love and missing her and something I intrinsically felt I'd been skirting. It felt very right, and she sounded very calm and sobered, but at peace. And until that last hour, I was worried she was going to die, and I would feel I had defended against what was most important and genuine to say. 12 hours before I was to see Mrs. K, she died, and I spoke with her family and all. Prior to this, I had talked to Ms. K about, was there anything she wanted me to do for her or her family after she died? And she wanted me to check on and see her husband, which I did. She felt the children were already placed in their own treatments, but if they wanted to come, fine. And I told her I would do all of that. And then she seemed at peace.
You know, Peggy, what I'm about to say, I'm hesitant because I don't want you to feel uncomfortable with it. But I think it's important to say, again, you're sharing with us so genuinely, as you did with the patient, really, about the love that you felt and how you were able, despite the boundary issue and all that stuff, but you were able to receive her and let her love you. And returned it in kind, and you are gracious enough to share it with us. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Harvey. Thank you.
There's a topic that I do want to get to about how this work changes your practice, but I want to say that you're sharing this with us changes all of us who listen to this kind of intimate psychoanalytic encounter. I think have to be changed by it. Not clear how, but it really reveals the heart and soul of what we do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we lose sight of that heart and soul. And it's important for all of us to be reminded of it.
It was also a nodal point in my work and also personally that I spent a lot of time later reconstructing all that had happened, what it meant to me, what happened to me as well, what kind of work was I doing. I was well aware that I was much more defended at the beginning of learning about her diagnosis, and that, you know, what began to override that was just the sense of humanity and closeness to her and my love for her. And what I put together over time, especially as I was writing about this, is there was all the sorrow about Ms. K and her family. And she's a lovely husband who gave me flowers after her death to thank me. That's a kind of generosity these people had. But I realized that I not only was very, very pressured inside ultimately to have the goodbye that I needed to have with her, knowing I wouldn't get another chance, which was the ramification of what had happened with my father 20 years or so prior. But it also touched something deeper. And again, this is now really thinking like a psychoanalyst, that I began to realize I had unconscious fears of suddenly having a terminal illness and having to say goodbye to my children and my husband and my family, and worrying about would I die alone because my extended family was in another city. So she opened the whole thing up for me, parts of myself I didn't know about.
Well, that's actually, for me, what's so powerful about it is that you are present with your heart and soul for your patient. I don't think that's not thinking like a psychoanalyst, by the way. I think it's just one facet of what we do.
Yes.
But in addition to that, you're also processing it in terms of understanding where it comes from in your past, what it reveals about you in your present, and you manage all of that together over time. And that's something that we can all have influence our practices. For sure.
I have to tell you, this is just an anecdote. There was a day in my treatment with her that I finished with my patients. I had to go to MGH to supervise the residents.
That's Mass General Hospital.
Right. Right. Mass General. And teach a seminar on termination. And then I had to leave Mass General and drive to the Boston Institute to teach the people training to be analysts, the candidates, a seminar on termination. So by 9:30 at night, driving home that night, I was convinced the entire world was dying and terminating, and that was my entire world.
Mark, you want to share how you have lived with this piece of the work?
Well, early on, and again, just to remind our listeners, as I started this work, I was also starting my analytic training in earnest. And, you know, as a candidate, there's such a concern about getting it right, really thinking about the work we're doing, concern about boundaries. And I found in my daily work, I was often struggling, you know, what is this that I'm doing? Is it analytic? And I remember, actually, this was the year before I knew I was going to start analytic training. This is just before I was in a fellowship, an analytic fellowship, and I brought a paper to a mentor, a great analyst, presented a paper, Janice Norton's paper, 65, I think it is, on treating the dying patient.
And getting the red dress, which is so poignant.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful paper, beautiful case. And it was a patient who was very actively, very much like your patient, Peggy, although it was a shorter treatment, the patient had come and I think was at that point struggling with poor prognosis. And the therapist is beautiful work, getting her through her death and really helping her be so much less alone in that. And I remember presenting it and wanting to talk about this paper to my mentor and thinking about it from an analytic perspective. And the mentor's only comment was like, well, this isn't psychoanalysis, so I don't really know what we have to talk about. I don't know I can say much. And what the mentorship was supposed to be was about analysis as analysis. And so there wasn't space made for it. But I think for me in that moment, it crystallized something for me that there are different forms of treatments, different states of being, as it were, as an analyst.
Yes.
But what I think fortunately happened for me was at first I felt like there was a conflict between becoming an analyst and working with cancer patients. But gradually in my work outside of analysis and outside of my training as a candidate, it was in my work in the cancer setting that I began to see that my way of responding to patients, of understanding what was going on for them in terms of feeling, in the intensity of that feeling, the regressive elements of what were happening, the shift in relationships, the experience of themselves as they're facing possible death or actual death, that all of this was something that I needed to be present in an analytic way with. And that right. Many of my colleagues in the broader field of psycho-oncology were wonderful, very present, quite existential, but didn't have that form of appreciation for what it was to be a patient who was dying. And I remember even one of the textbooks had a line where, you know, you do this work with a patient and if they become intensely emotional and don't seem to be responding to the treatment, which I think was a CBT protocol, probably for depression or anxiety in the face of death, refer them to counseling. And I always remember that line. What's this counseling you're talking about that's somehow outside of therapy and doesn't have to do with being with our patients as they're experiencing intense affect? So I think that's how I reconcile that over time. And in my work as an analyst, I think I've come to really wonder about what boundaries mean for us. I mean, there's clearly the issue of ethical boundaries, there's boundaries of safety of the patient, there's boundaries on the work in terms of frame. But do we do it because we're supposed to, that this is the way one is an analyst, which I do not believe, versus that we use them in ways that are of benefit for the patient and hold the treatment together. Mm-hmm. But we also have to be able to shift when the patient needs us to shift. And I felt mm-hmm. that is one thing that changed profoundly for me in working with cancer patients, mm-hmm. being able to make that movement in the interest mm-hmm. of the patient. And when I would slip, go too far, pulling myself back.
Mm-hmm. I think, Mark, you raised such an important issue. And Harvey, this is really, I think, how really grateful I am that you would open us this discussion, because it's not talked about that much. Mm-hmm. What is it like to be a clinician with a patient who either comes because they're going to be dying or it happens in the treatment? And what is it like for the clinician? It's lonely in a way, because there is a lot of parallel with what the patient's going through. And to me, as a field, I would like to think we could talk about this, write about it. My peer group at the time was terribly important to me. Colleagues, people that basically would be with me in this. But in the end, you know, I was the one that went to alone the service at the funeral home. And I went to my patient's luncheon, not to have the lunch, but to talk to the family. And then I left. I didn't stay for the lunch. I thought that might be a little intrusive. But, you know, there's nothing really to read about, talk about, whatever, pick somebody's brain about, you know, how did they experience this in their work? Or I don't really understand why we've been so quiet about this in our work.
I think it's because it's as difficult as it is, and it involves issues of boundaries and love, which is perhaps psychoanalysis 3.0. It's what we now have to wrap our head around, and not that there are easy, glib answers to it. None of us are suggesting that, but it's much more difficult if we don't acknowledge that those are the issues we need to face.
I agree with you.
A thought when you mentioned about being alone in it, and there is a way in which it's very true. I think in large part because not many of our colleagues have had this experience, and they're often the people we talk to. But on the flip side, I maybe because I've worked with so many patients and that I'm beginning to notice a certain consistency. Maybe it's me, but I've also had such an experience of close intimacy with these patients.
Yes,
in a way that I don't always, and like there's a closeness that's to be had, particularly in analytic work and work over time. But yes, it happens quite quickly, I feel, in work with dying patients.
Yes.
And in that regard, I felt less alone in my work. In some ways, in the rest of our work, because we maintain a more careful distance in a way, a boundary with the patient, a frame, I feel with the dying patient, I feel like both of us are more in the room together.
That's a very good point, and it feels kind of rarefied in a way. The time is short, and I think Harvey, you're right that we don't talk about this enough, because it really has to do with love and a really kind of very special intimate bond, and also with actually three of the patients, including this one that I worked with who died, you become a bit part of the family as well. So, which is another shift that we may not be so used to.
There's so much more we could say, but I guess not only is this about love and boundaries, but also about time. And I have to interrupt us based on time, not based on lack of interest, for sure. I want to thank you both. I've known you both for some time, and I've learned from both of you a great deal, and even more so today. So it's a pleasure to share the learning with so many people who will be listening to this. So
thank you. It's a privilege.
Thank you both.
Thank
it's been
you.
A pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.